Welcome to the Personality Psychology Podcast. My name is Rebecca Weidmann and I'm the host of this episode. I'm thrilled to have Theo Klimstra and Kate McLean on the podcast today. Theo Klimstra is a senior lecturer of child study and human development at Tufts University. Kate McLean is a professor of psychology at Western Washington University. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, good morning.
You recently had a target article accepted for publication in the European Journal of Personality. The paper is titled Reconsidering Normative Interpretations in Personality Research. What is this paper about and what drew you to that topic?
What we're talking about, what we're addressing in the paper is we use certain language, certain ways to describe our findings. And of course, whenever you use language, you could say it's just language, but it also comes with values. And our language is just one way to communicate our values. What we try to address in the paper is that we should reflect on the values that we bring to our research. And for this, we focused mostly on the concept of personality maturation. Part of what drew me to specifically to that is because I've written a lot about personality maturation. And then over the years, especially as I reviewed other people's articles, I'll just be honest about that, and it didn't necessarily come from my own research, I got a little bit less comfortable with the phrasing that I had also used. So therefore, I felt like we should reconsider, we should reflect what personality maturation actually means and whether the patterns that we label as personality maturation can really be described as such. And it doesn't just apply to personality maturation. It's similar with my own research on identity formation. What we do is often have these identity statuses, and then we also say that somebody has a more established identity. But if you don't know in what context, in what situation an individual is, you don't know whether it's really like more adaptive or more adjusted. So therefore, I felt like it would be good to start a paper with it. And it's always good to find like-minded people if you're about to write something like that. And I think over the years, Kate and I have been involved in some kind of conversations about this. And so therefore, we wrote this together. So yeah.
Theo asked me to join him on this journey, and I was very excited too. I think everything Theo said is spot on, of course. And what I had been thinking about a lot when Theo approached me was beyond personality, but also again, own work. I've been sort of reflecting on the language that I've used or how I've even conceptualized, you know, healthy development, for example, and feeling like in our discipline broadly, psychology, we focus too much on the individual and sort of place responsibility for healthy development or maturation or positive functioning entirely on the individual. And we don't pay enough attention to the larger context that the individual is embedded in that play a big role in whether you're developing well or not. So that's where my thinking had been. And then agreed that our ideas of what developing well mean are often based on such narrow samples that it's really hard to generalize, even though we do all the time. And that seems like a practice we might want to reconsider.
And so in your article, you speak about certain terms that people should stop using, but also going beyond the language. Can you speak more about that?
One thing I think that is important to emphasize that we could definitely imagine, or at least I could imagine, that there are situations where you can call certain patterns of personality change within a particular context, within a particular group of people, might be able to call it maturation. However, it's really hard to figure out when that is the case and for whom. And what we really try to write about in the paper is that the way we have used it is like in a very generalized way, basically that it applies to the same pattern of change, that it could be regarded as maturation in everyone. And that's the main thing that we want to address. So it's not so much the language. However, it also still is the language, but it's really more a deeper reflection on the values that we bring. And those values do come out in the form of language, as of course, in our writing, because that's how we communicate.
It's a bit like a rabbit hole, you know, so language is like the vehicle for understanding our values or what we bring to it. So if we think increasing agreeableness, for example, in emerging adulthood is a sign of maturation. Why do we think that? Oh, well, because agreeableness is associated with some positive characteristics, right? Well, why do we think those are positive characteristics? And who is not increasing in agreeableness? And might there be reasons that people are not increasing in agreeableness that are really important for us to pay attention to? So it's like you could go down all these rabbit holes around the assumptions we have that we haven't really examined, using language to think about why did we decide this was right, like based on what data, you know? And so I think that's sort of the reflection we're encouraging. And we were hesitant to provide lots of solutions right away because it seems really important to first think through how we got here for all of us, you know, and then to think, okay, what might be appropriate solutions to some of these concerns.
So sticking with this example of agreeableness, one could also say personality maturation for an emerging adult could also mean becoming less agreeable in some situations. Like for example, maybe they've been a people pleaser and being nice to everyone, and then realizing, actually, this is not helpful for me, and maybe I should set more boundaries. And that could likewise be personality maturation, depending on their situation or upbringing or family situation, friendship, high school, and so forth.
Exactly. So you're thinking in a very ideographic way, right? Like for this person, what does it mean to mature, right? And it might be a different pathway. There are individual differences in pathways of development. And then even further, you might say, well, these emerging adults or maybe in particular adolescents who are becoming more disagreeable or less agreeable, it might be because they're seeing things in their world that are distressing to them, right? Maybe they're resisting some forms of oppression that they're facing and they're pushing against what they're supposed to be doing. And that might be incredibly mature, right? To see the way in which the world might not fit with how you would like to be living, how you, you know, vision for your future, and to try to resist the normative cultural expectations to create something more just, right? That's a very dramatic example, but why we would call that immaturity gives us pause.
Yeah, related to that, just more generally, we even have a section in the article specifically on adolescents. Even if you look more broadly, you could say that there is a developmental task. It's also tricky to talk about those because they're also less generalizable than we often like to believe they are. But nonetheless, like adolescence is this transition between childhood and adulthood. So as an individual, you are to a certain degree expected to, well, find your own way in life. And that might lead to some like disagreeableness as well towards your parents, for example. And that's just one example of how this can be functional. And it's not just for agreeableness. You could even say for things like emotional stability or neuroticism, whatever you want to call it, some small increases in that might also be adaptive in a certain way. If you think of neuroticism, for example, as something like a warning system, if you're living in a situation where it's adaptive to be a little bit more neurotic, then is that really a bad thing? But again, of course, we're not saying that like everybody should be neurotic or something. But what we're trying to address is that we should just really think a little bit more about like contextualizing our findings at the individual level. It could also be at the cultural level, at the regional level, neighborhood level. Well, think about all the levels that we have. Part of this also comes perhaps from our background, as we are not just in personality psychology, we are also in developmental science. You think about a Bronfenbrenner approach with all these systems that are really not that separable, but that are really like all part of our experience at the same time, basically. It's helpful to think about like different levels of the system because otherwise it gets a little bit complicated for our thinking. But all of those systems do affect our thinking and do affect like what is adaptive and what may not be adaptive. But broad generalizations about that can just be difficult to make. That's the main thing that we want to talk about.
Just to add on to that broad generalizations without reasonable data to make them, meaning data from large swaths of people in really different contexts. I mean, it might be that, you know, decreasing neuroticism is adaptive for everyone, but we don't know because we haven't looked at that. We haven't examined enough different kinds of contexts, enough different kinds of populations, enough different kinds of developmental trajectories to really see if that is an adaptive or healthy course of development. So it's really the call is to rethink the way that we conceptualize maturity or healthy development and the labels we use, and also to think really carefully about the data we have to make the claims we have, which is, there's a lot of data, but it's pretty narrow.
Can you, for those who might be outside of our field, say what our data has been focusing on in the past and who have we been like not sampling or not been able to sample?
Well, in personality psychology, of course, we've always had a very broad toolkit However, the approaches that have been more commonly used, or that perhaps personality psychology is a little bit more known for, are trait level approaches, like including the Big Five. And for example, with the maturity principle that we're mostly talking about in the paper, yeah, a lot of that is based on the Big Five. So what we are arguing for as well, partly also based on our own research, because we have been doing things different from the Big Five, for example, of narrative identity research, Kate, much more than I did, but like we've both been involved in that type of research. And then you just learn different things because you have the stories that people tell. Whereas with the Big Five, like one limitation that you could say with a quantitative approach is that you don't always see the personal reflections of the individuals. You don't have that little personal touch that you might have with a narrative approach, for example. But yeah, that's not the only two approaches. There's also motives and goals. And especially if you think about motives and goals, if you combine that with the Big Five, for example, then you might know a little bit more about why a person tries to increase in agreeableness or decrease in agreeableness. And if we only look at one level of personality, then some of that gets lost as well. So of course, like cultural context, social context, and all of that, but it's also just looking at personality more broadly that might already help us move forward.
And the reliance on the Big Five really means that we're relying on self-report surveys, which are great in many ways, as we all know. They're quick and easy and cheap and all those sorts of things that are important. But you have to have access to them. So whether that's via, the internet or you're in your research institution, you have to speak the language and be comfortable in the language. You have to conceptualize your personality in that way. So there's a lot of methodological limitations to such a narrow assessment, which is really the bulk of the research on personality maturation has been using the same self-report surveys, which again are great. We both use them and will continue to use them, but it's giving us, as Teo said, such a small slice of what personality is and such a small slice of our global population who can participate in such research.
Because to add to that, many of these tools like the Big Five, if you look at the original research from which it came, it was mostly conducted here in the US, then it was translated into Dutch, and like the whole procedure of the lexical approach was done all over again in several countries. But even within those countries, if you look at like who was included in that research, it's a relatively narrow population as well. It's often highly educated people, college students. And beyond that, even if you look at a global level, also those lexical studies haven't been conducted in all that many countries and in all that many languages, because we can look at countries, but also countries usually have multiple languages, and some people are more comfortable in one language and other people are more comfortable in another language. And even within the language, there's different dialects. Same would actually go for even our narrative prompts. We also use particular words that might work with some of our participants, but not with other participants. So it's a broader problem, and we should really reflect on that as well. And again, this does not just apply to personality psychology. It applies very much to developmental science. At quite a few discussions as well over the years over our identity measures, for example. There's a lot of language in there. It's very accessible to identity researchers, but perhaps not so much to the people who actually fill out the questionnaire. So therefore, rethinking that is part of our goal as well with this paper, to get the discussion on it going.
When I look at my work, or everyone looks at their own work, what would be a good next step? What would something small be that we can all do to improve in the direction you would like to see the field go?
So when I think about this in my own work, there's a couple of things. One is to just reinterpret what we've already done. So not even collecting data in a different way, but just thinking contextually about the work that we're already doing. So bringing that kind of lens to, okay, so I'm giving this survey to a bunch of teenagers at this particular school in this particular moment in time. And how might I interpret what I'm seeing from a more contextual lens? So that would be one really pretty easy thing to do, is just to bring in that framework of, this is not a decontextualized process that we're looking at. What is the school? Did I collect the data during COVID or not? Or the next level might be measuring some aspects of those contexts, right? So of actually assessing aspects of people's lives, the families they're in, the neighborhoods they're in, their social location in terms of class or race or ethnicity or gender, those sorts of things that might impact their developmental course or be related to their developmental course. So those would be sort of two measurement assessment kinds of things that an individual could do. And then broadly, I think our field just has got to be more methodologically broad. I mean, when you think of the barriers to doing different kinds of research in our publishing, the, you know, the way that our journals work. I think my internet connection is getting unstable. So Tao, you might have to take over.
Okay, well, what Kate was getting to, if I just look at my own work, like one of my own articles that I'm criticizing perhaps the most, or at least one of my first author articles that I'm criticizing the most in the paper, is a study from 2009. It's called Maturation of Personality in Adolescence. It has very like prominently maturation in there in the title. If I look at it like at the statistical analyses, then there are some things that I might do a slightly differently, but across the board, what I'm most concerned about is my own interpretations there. I could imagine, I'm not going to do that, but I could imagine like, at least rethinking how I would write it now rather than actually rewriting it. It's really the introduction section, the discussion sections, even the result section to a certain degree, to really reflect on that. How would I write about this differently now that I have a little bit of a different perspective on personality maturation than or personality change than I had back then? Part of what I was also thinking about, so in my teaching here at Tufts, we have particular courses, Childhood Across Cultures is one of the favorite courses that I teach. What we sometimes do there is just pick a concept and then talk with the class about how this may or may not ring with people living in different contexts in different situations. If you teach a course titled Childhood Across Cultures, typically also attracts a pretty diverse group of students who all have their own lived experiences. And using those kind of places to see like whether my lived experiences and the concept I use because of my lived experiences resonate with other people's lived experiences or not can also be like just a tiny little exercise to sort of see, whether what we're doing actually resonates with the people we're studying. That's one way forward as well. So really reflecting on your existing work, but also just talking about your existing work and how it may or may not apply to a group of people who might be very different from who you are. So
there's also the idea and a lot of people have argued for this across disciplines in psychology, but taking a step back towards doing more descriptive work. So rather than assuming that we're ready to start testing, you know, explanatory hypotheses, sort of going back to the, okay, what does agreeableness look like in different contexts, you know, or what does a healthier, mature person, how's that defined in different contexts? So going back to some more descriptive work before we jump to the explanations is also something that a lot of people are talking about is necessary for psychology.
Yeah, somewhat related to that as well. Just check with your respondents, like what particular items actually mean to them, because like one of the limitations you could also say of a quantitative approach is that you have these questions, you ask the question, you get a number in return, but somewhere along the way, you have to make the assumption that your participant understood the question in the way you understood it. And that might not always be the case. Yeah, even studies perhaps just adding open-ended questions to your multiple choice questions. Some studies using that kind of design might also be useful.
This is something I've adapted years ago. Moin Syed started to do at the end of a study is to just have an open-ended question of like, what was it like to participate in this study? And that doesn't always work, depends on the kinds of questions you're asking. Sometimes it's incredibly rich. But if you were to say, we're interested in, you know, how people function well within their communities and what does it mean to function well? So that's what we were asking you about, but in your own words, you know, what does it mean to be functioning well? And functioning well might not be the right phrasing, but just asking people what they think, you know, it could be enlightening.
We kind of did that in some of our identity studies as well. We have this questionnaire called Dimensions of Identity Development Scale, the DIDS. All the questions are about future orientation. So future is in there a lot. Well, we kind of never knew what people actually thought about when they saw future. So we just asked. And then turned out that if you asked, at least in our study on Dutch adolescents, there was a large majority that had sort of similar ideas about what future entailed. But there were also particular individuals who had a very different interpretation of what future entailed. So just having that information and doing something with it, of course, can be pretty enlightening as well.
Thank you so much. Is there anything else you would like to comment on? Anything else we haven't discussed yet?
So I can talk a little bit about that. We were actually very happy that this was selected as a target article, mm-hmm. because often what happens if we talk about values and things, doing our research differently, one of the dangers is that we come across as very judgy and think that we're mm-hmm. better than everybody else, and that emphatically that's not the path that we want to go down. Mm-hmm. So we're very happy actually that there will be commentaries, because mm-hmm. that allows us to have a more of a conversation about this, because that's one of the other things that is not always great about the kind of way that we publish our papers. Often publish a paper and then it's done, whereas mm-hmm. especially with topics like these, it's just good to have a conversation style with them going back and forth, because mm-hmm. we don't want to alienate people.
We definitely approached this paper with the, how can we call people into the conversation? And so critiquing our own work was one way to do that. But to really, we don't have all of the answers. We just see something that makes us uncomfortable in terms of the lack of awareness and sort of the strength of the claims that we're making. So we're hopeful that this could be a larger conversation in our scientific community that will be really productive and probably hard and challenging and mm-hmm. all those sorts of things, but could be really productive and make our science so much better, hopefully.
Thank you so much for your work and being here.